in the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're going to sit down with the mayor of Salt Lake City, Aaron Mendenhall, to talk about the $85 million general obligation bond that will appear on your November ballot for parks, trails, and open space improvements. That's the start of the show. Later, we'll turn to a famous radio hoax, maybe one of the most famous hoaxes ever, that happened 84 years ago this month, and which maybe didn't actually have the effect you think it had. Stay tuned for that. But again, to begin with, yesterday I walked across Library and Washington Squares into the City and County Building and up to a room off of the mayor's office to have a conversation with Aaron Mendenhall. Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, thank you so much for making time. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to talk with you.
There is an $85 million bond that is going to be on the November ballot for Salt Lake City residents on November 8th. It's for parks, trails, and open space improvements. Let's leave aside the kind of property tax questions just for a moment and focus in on what the objective or the idea of this is and who came up with this idea. Where did it come from?
It came from Salt Lakers, who flooded into our parks and trails, about 40% more use of our parks and trails beginning with the pandemic, but we've actually sustained it till these days right now when it's like we remembered how much we need and love connecting with nature and being able to do so really conveniently from our homes. At the same time, Salt Lake City's growing in tremendous ways. We added over 4,000 units of housing last year. It's going to happen again this year. And of course, it's not just single individuals moving into each of those. So our population is growing, and it's growing vertically for the most part. People's access to not just being able to take your dog out for a pee after work, but having a place to recreate and play and have fun, maybe even connect with those great foothill trails and other trails in the city, is becoming an increasing need with the population growth here.
And these are priorities that were identified by, there was a public process that reached out to the public. People said, yeah, here's what we think ought to be done in our neighborhoods. And these are these sort of priorities, like eight. There are eight in total, and I can kind of We can drill down on each of those, and I want to do that actually, but first, this is for voters to decide, and as I read the question, I have a draft ballot that tells me, you know, what this bond would do. From my understanding, there's an estimated property tax of $54 per year, or roughly $54, a little bit less than that, on the average home in Salt Lake City over a 20-year period, though I think it's kind of a replacement of existing bond obligations from what that language seems to say to me. Which means that residents, if they approve this, won't see their property taxes go down, but they won't necessarily see them go up either. Is that correct? It's really kind of confusing on the ballot.
Well, thank you for letting us know that the ballot language is confusing, and let's try to sort that out. Back to the beginning of that comment you made, Reimagine Nature was the public process, and a lot of Salt Lakers participated in that, literally asking you, let's reimagine the public park spaces, trail spaces, and open spaces that we're using today to figure out what would we want in those spaces that's better, that serves us better, that would activate more residents into those public spaces. And at the same time, let's imagine some new spaces like the Glendale Regional Park. That's one of the eight big projects in this bond. We haven't built a regional park in the city in over 60 years, and that was Sugar House Park that opened most recently. We only have two in our great city, Sugar House and Liberty Park, and absolutely no regional park on the west side. So this would make that first new regional park in a very long time. When it comes down to the taxes, there wouldn't actually be, it's likely that there would be $0 on the next year of property taxes. That the way we've been able to structure this would be zero payment at the beginning, and then up to about $5 for that median priced household
per month.
From a value perspective. So. Yeah.
$5 per month, right? Is that
yes? Okay, yeah, just so. About $5 per month, $54 or so a year. When it comes to bonding capacity, we actually did a sales tax bond as well in this last budget session, and that was taking space where we'd paid down a bond on the Sorensen ice sheet up there. Back to pre-Olympic times, we'd committed several million dollars to help build that. We paid that off, and so the sales tax bond took that capacity. It didn't cost Salt Lakers anything more. It just filled up the space, but not really knowing what the growth potential is going to look like. We feel confident saying $5 a month for the median-priced household in Salt Lake City. Mm. It could be less, but I want people to anticipate $5.
Understood. Wasn't there just a property tax increase as well in that in the most recent budget process? Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's right.
It's
a good question because, as the Tribune reported, 90% of taxing entities in the state did a property tax increase this year. We had kind of all had it coming, but Salt Lake City hasn't done a property tax increase since 2014. And yet our population, our city, has been growing incredibly. Even through the pandemic, we continue to see record-setting valuations of permits coming through. $2.4 billion worth of permits came through last year. Blew out of the water the previous numbers. So given all of the growth that's happening here, there's a lot more demands on your capital city for all of the services, from first responders to people processing permits, parks being used, streets being repaired, and we haven't grown our staffing capacity the way that we need to respond to that. We passed a property tax increase of 4.9%, and on top of that, the library also asked for a property tax increase for their single line item of that. And we also added back in governmental immunity, which doesn't make us immune, but it actually is the line in the budget that since the last recession actually was taken out of property tax and competed with everything else in the budget. It's the fund that the city pays out when we either settle or we lose in a lawsuit. And that's a really volatile number from year to year. It's been difficult at times in the city's history. They've had to go to a budget amendment in order to put that funding together. You combine the library, the property tax, and the governmental immunity, and all together, that was about a $55 a year increase for the medium-priced household.
Okay. And this, over time, would be a little bit less than that per year on the median price or household. But again, I think we're in the weeds here. I'm sorry.
We're nerding too hard here on property tax. But the details are important, and voters can dig in and go to the city's website, and you can read up on both the parks and open space bond and the details of how that property tax is rendered. Plenty of information there also on the one that was already approved by the council.
Okay, let's dig in just on the details of the actual project itself. And you mentioned the Glendale Regional Park, the first regional park since Sugar House Park replaced the old prison site there. It's a $27 million project. What does it envision? What's the idea behind the Glendale Park, Regional Park?
We need a great place to play, and there's even more kids on the west side per capita than there are anywhere else in the city. Back when Ted Wilson was the mayor, he was able to get some federal funds that allowed the city to purchase that property, but it bound the city to use that property for recreation in perpetuity. The creation of a water park there was a great use of recreation. And did you know that the hill where the water slides come down from at the former Raging Waters site there is mostly constructed of the sand from the sandbags from the 1983 flood in Salt Lake City?
Did not know that.
Just a little bit of city fun fact for you there. We want to keep that structure of the steel that held up the top end of those slides. I think it'll be a great art opportunity and sort of an icon of what was the use of that property. We want to activate the river. There's a great website you can go to for the Glendale Regional Park, Salt Lake City. Check out what the community is asking for. They want to engage with the water as well, but not necessarily only with the river. Getting access, whether it's a pool or a splash pad or some other water opportunity, is a high priority for the community. Think about farmers markets, festivals, a space where performances can happen, playgrounds. And the regional park is being built around what the community wants.
Kind of a Liberty Park for the west side, but not quite as big, I guess.
And because we're dealing with new technology, and I mean that even in the sense of what a playground looks like today. By the way, the bond also includes a new playground for Liberty Park, a brand new full playground. I think the regional park of today is naturally going to look a lot different than the two regional parks we have.
You mentioned a pool, like a splash pool or something. I nearly drowned in the Raging Waters wave pool when I was a kid.
I'm sorry to bring that traumatic memory up for you.
I wasn't really drowning. I just wasn't a good swimmer. Okay. So Yeah, and you said there's a website where we can see it rendered, what the community is asking for. I will put a link up to that with this story. The city's Glendale golf course is right adjacent to this. I think it's across railroad tracks, though. Is this going to cut into that golf course at all?
No, it doesn't take anything from the golf course. It's really just the Raging Waters property. But we've also got Allen Park on the list of the eight projects. Yep. And if you think back, the pandemic was kind of like dog years. It feels longer ago, but the acquisition of Allen Park happened for the city in, I think, April of 2020.
This is directly across from Westminster College.
That's right.
Roughly, yeah.
Yes, okay. Yes. And there's some really unique old buildings in there. And we want to make it more accessible also for more of the space that comes up to the river as well, while also making sure we're protecting the water quality there. So Allen Park is one of the major investments that would come out of this bond.
Completing the Folsom Trail is another one of those. Actually, let's skip that for a second.
But it's a good one.
All right, well, tell me.
It would finally connect the Folsom Trail all the way through to the Jordan River Parkway Trail.
Okay.
And creating that network of trails, Jordan River Parkway Trail is phenomenal, over 80 miles long. We built the bridge, the Archie and Lois Archuleta Bridge, that connects that last gap there. The Folsom Trail would be just north of that. It'll finally pop through and be able to connect you almost into the downtown.
Right, into the gateway area, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, how about there's a general priority on this bond to improve at least one park in every one of the city council districts. What does that mean improvement-wise? I mean, what's the...
That came out of the Reimagine Nature process. That was a lot of community engagement, listening to people, getting ideas out of our residents who are using the parks today and helping us reimagine, obviously, what kind of activations and amenities they want to see in those spaces. So the community told us what they want. This bond responds to that in every single council district. Check it out on the website to see what the details are.
Okay. The Fleet Block seems like a kind of big sort of to be determined part of what mm-hmm. this is. There's like a park that is maybe going to be put there, or hard to say exactly what it's going to be. Why is that so kind of up in the air? Do you know what I mean? Is that
yeah. When I started out as mayor in my first state of the city, I said we are finally going to develop the Fleet Block, which, if you don't know, is between 8th and 9th South and 3rd to 4th West, and the city owns the majority of that lot. It has been sitting there for over a decade waiting for us. And then George Floyd is murdered, mm-hmm. and a social movement begins. And family members and loved ones of people who had died at the hands of police officers in the state of Utah started putting up murals on these empty buildings that really can't be saved and are not going to be saved by the city in whatever development happens there. But it became the grounds for community to come together, to mourn, to be with each other, and to remember their loved ones who are lost. We recognized that there was a lot of healing and processing that needed to happen with the community in order for the city to imagine what should happen next on that block with the community. That was an art healing process that we have wrapped up, actually. We've heard from those family members and loved ones who participated. Their feedback is going to be influencing the request for proposals, the RFP that we will be putting out on the Fleet Block. And we want there to be a community gathering space as a component of that block. This funding in the bond would help us have that seed money for whatever that future park-like community gathering space activation will be.
Okay. This is, I think, maybe the largest single investment, or would be the largest single investment in parks in city history. How big of a deal is this to your sort of mayoral legacy, to you? If voters have to decide whether or not they're going to approve this. I'm sure you have lots of things that you would put your stamp on, but how big of a deal is this to you?
This is a legacy, but it's a legacy for Salt Lakers. And it comes out of the recognition that we had in the last couple of years of how precious these open spaces are, not just for the beauty around us, but for our mental health, our well-being, and our connection to our communities. And with the density of population that we're adding here, which, again, a lot of that's our own kids, we want them to be able to live here with us, we want quality of life. I believe climate change is the number one issue facing our global community. We grapple with that as Salt Lakers with our air pollution. We grapple with it in replacing the 3,000 trees that the windstorm ripped out. We're planting 1,000 extra trees on the west side every year. The reality is the more connected you are to something, the more you care about it. And I think that's the legacy part, that as Salt Lakers, we want to have nature and experience that beauty on a daily basis. But it's not naturally going to happen by the private market. You need your local government to prioritize shared public spaces that aren't just a place to go walk your dog, as I said, after work, but that actually connect you and give you a sense of place and a sense of belonging with the community you live in. That's the legacy I hope that we vote on. And I can't advocate for people to vote yes or no at this point. Just look at the facts and please do vote however you vote. It'll be the only Salt Lake City specific issue on the ballot this November.
And again, that's Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall. We'll include some links and further details on this $85 million bond proposal along with today's show post. I'll also direct you to the county clerk's website, which allows you to put in your address and see precisely what will be on your ballot, including U.S. Senate and House races, the race to replace outgoing county clerk Sherry Swenson, and more. We'll be featuring a deeper look at your ballot as the November 8th election approaches. Stay tuned. Now on the show, as we are approaching the anniversary of a very famous hoax, we'll delve into KCBW's audio archives for a radio piece I put together examining a much earlier experiment in this medium of radio that went, supposedly, awry.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water.
That's Orson Welles in the original radio production of War of the Worlds, which aired over the Columbia Broadcasting System, or CBS, radio network.
With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Those clips of Welles come from the very beginning of an archived recording of that broadcast, and, along with the show's earlier introduction, make it pretty clear that what you're listening to is a work of fiction. But some radio listeners who tuned in late, or who weren't paying attention, or who were just scanning through the radio dial, apparently couldn't discern that what they were listening to was a made-for-radio drama when they heard, say, this.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again, out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. I guess that's it. Yes, I guess that's the thing directly in front of me, half buried in a vast pit. Must have struck with terrific force. The ground is covered with splinters of a tree. It must have struck on its way down. But I can see the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor. At least not the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. Well, I've never seen anything like it. The color is sort of yellowish white.
You're likely already familiar with the rest of this tale. People thought a Martian invasion was underway. There was mass hysteria with Americans packing up their belongings and trying to get to safety. It was chaos.
That's the myth, that this program was so effective and so powerful and so clever that it sent the country into spasms of mass panic and hysteria. And there's just no evidence to support that.
That's American University media professor W. Joseph Campbell, author of Getting It Wrong, 10 of the Greatest Misreported Stories in American Journalism.
Newspapers really exaggerated the extent of the fright that night. A growing body of scholarship points to the fact that there was very little evidence of panic and hysteria, and whatever fear and disturbance there was that night was on a very, very small scale, which is quite contrary to the story, which is a great story, and it lives on, and it has made that broadcast, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds dramatization, probably the best-known radio show ever aired.
A story by the Associated Press, printed in the Salt Lake Tribune on Halloween Day in 1938,
paints a picture of frantic evacuations and panic nationwide, complete with, quote, weeping and hysterical women swamping telephone switchboards. The Tribune reported that its own switchboard was flooded with calls, people wanting to know, is this real? Is the East Coast of the United States really being invaded by Martians? Or at least that's what the Tribune reported happening.
So newspapers took the opportunity in the aftermath of the War of the Worlds broadcast to really slam radio for not being as sophisticated, for not being as responsible as daily newspapers, because radio was an increasingly important competitor to newspapers. Newspapers are still the dominant medium of the time, but radio was increasingly important as a source for news and as a source for advertising. And newspapers recognized this challenge, and the War of the Worlds broadcast and the panic that it supposedly created was a golden opportunity for many large city newspapers to slam radio, to rebuke radio, to admonish radio for being unable to keep separate news and fantasy.
In that same Halloween article, the Tribune points out that switchboard operators at the Salt Lake City Police and Fire Departments, at the city jail, and at Fort Douglas reported that nobody, not one person, called in with any concerns. Meanwhile, their own switchboards were, as they reported, flooded. So is the story that Orson Welles' adaptation of H.G. Wells' famous tale caused mass hysteria in America likely to go away anytime soon? Again, W. Joseph Campbell.
It is a good story. It is a memorable story. It's one that we like to believe these days because, in a way, it kind of reassures ourselves that we are savvy media consumers, that we, unlike the listeners to that show back in 1938, we wouldn't be duped like that. So there is, I think, good reason that this tale lives on, that has lived on for 77 years after it aired, because it's somewhat reassuring to us. It helps us as contemporary media consumers to indulge quietly, privately, in a feeling of sophistication and superiority, that we are media-wise, that we are media-savvy, and we wouldn't be so gullible as they were back then.
We'll give the last word on the matter to the master himself, Orson Welles, from a Halloween Day press conference, 1938.
I am terribly shocked by the effect it's had. I do not believe that the method is original with me or peculiar to the Mercury Theater's presentation.
Do you think there ought to be a law against such enactments as we had last night or as a result of that?
I don't know what the legislation would be. I know that almost everybody in radio would do almost anything to avert the kind of thing that has happened, myself included, but I don't know what the legislation would be. We simply, radio is new and we are learning about the effect it has on people. Learned a terrible lesson.
Do you think that this will cause the curbing?
With KCPW, I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Thanks indeed for listening. That does it for this edition of In the Hive. You can find this and all of our past programs over at kcpw.org. Thanks for tuning in. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.